This episode features discussion of kidnapping and extreme violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
In Munich, Germany, on the night of September 4th, 1972, the 20th Olympic Games had less than a week left.
That night, most of the Israeli delegation went to see a German production of the musical Fiddler on the Roof, starring renowned Israeli actor Shmuel Rodensky. They even got to go backstage to meet Rodensky and celebrate with him before piling back onto the bus to return to the Olympic Village.
The athletes, coaches, and officials went to sleep happy, flushed from the celebratory evening, and looking forward to heading home in a few days.
Shortly after 4:30 a.m., 40-year-old wrestling referee Josef Gutfreund was wakened by a noise at the front door. Not wanting to disturb the other coaches, judges, and referees with whom he shared the apartment, he quietly climbed out of bed and padded out into the foyer in his underwear.
Just then, the front door creaked open just enough to reveal masked men carrying AK-47 machine guns.
The 6'3", 285-pound wrestler slammed his full weight against the door and shouted for the others to wake up and run while he tried to hold the attackers off.
Within seconds, his roommate, Tuvia Sokolovsky, a Holocaust survivor, jumped out of bed and ran into the living room. Seeing the AK-47 wedged into the open door and Gutfreund trying to hold off the intruders, Sokolovsky bolted for the window.
He shouted for the others to run as he tried to open the window, but the lock jammed. In a panic, Sokolovsky punched through the glass and dove through the window, his hand bleeding profusely.
Machine gun fire followed him as he started to run through the garden. The attackers had made it through the door, and Gutfreund.
Within 30 seconds of Gutfreund's attempt to block the door and rouse his companions, six Israeli athletes had been taken hostage, and more would join them within minutes.
This is Hostage on the Parcast Network. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive. I'm Carter Roy.
And I'm Irma Blanco. You can listen to all of Parcast's podcasts on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Thursday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
If you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen. This is our first episode on the kidnapping of 11 members of the Israeli Olympic team by Black September at the 1972 Munich Olympics, an event known as the Munich Massacre.
In the early hours of September 5th, 1972, 11 Israeli athletes, coaches, and Olympic officials were held hostage by 8 commandos from the Palestinian terrorist group known as Black September. The standoff lasted for nearly 24 hours. It brought the Olympics to a halt and focused the world's attention both on the capital of the German state of Bavaria and on the Palestinian Revolutionary Movement. One of the first modern ideological terrorist attacks, the kidnapping and response had repercussions for the next half century.
This week, we'll look at the Israeli Olympic team, Black September and the Palestine Liberation Organization, and the dramatic events surrounding the initial kidnapping.
Next week, in part two, we'll track the negotiations that took place between the hostage takers and the Munich police, along with the Bavarian, West German, and Israeli governments. We'll also delve into the psychology of a long, sleepless hostage situation, and we'll explore how a delicate political situation was partially responsible for the mistakes that ultimately led to a tragic ending.
The Israeli Olympic delegation knew from the moment their attackers opened the door that the men were Arabic. But the athletes weren't political men, so they may not have realized just what being taken hostage by Black September meant.
A shadowy organization, Black September burst onto the international scene less than a year prior to the Munich Olympics. In that time, the group had perpetrated a number of attacks designed to raise the profile of the plight of the Palestinian Arabs and take revenge on those deemed enemies of the Palestinian people.
The group was able to be so effective so quickly because Black September didn't just appear out of thin air. It was, in fact, an unofficial branch of Fatah, Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Revolutionary Group, which was itself under the umbrella of the Palestine Liberation Organization, or the PLO.
Yes, the politics of the Palestinian Liberation Groups were complicated in the 1960s and 70s, but their history went back to the origins of the modern Israel-Palestine conflict.
The modern Israeli-Palestinian conflict didn't start with Israel's founding as a country in 1948. It started in the late 1800s with the influx of European Jewish nationalists known as Zionists, who dreamed of founding a Jewish state in the land their ancestors had been driven out of more than 1,000 years earlier.
In the ensuing half-century, the Palestinian Arabs' initial wariness of their new neighbors became hostile. The British exacerbated the problem by promising both groups that they would recognize their respective autonomous states and then occupied the region under the pretense of keeping the peace.
Violence broke out sporadically through the 1920s, 30s, and 40s until, in the wake of World War II and the Holocaust, the international community decided to intervene. In 1947, the new United Nations decided to divide the region into two countries, one Jewish and one Arab.
In late 1947, though, fighting broke out between militant groups and the UN scrapped the partition plan. But the fighting didn't stop. In May 1948, the British threw up their hands, announcing they were leaving, and as the Zionists looked to be winning, recognized the new state of Israel.
The conflict drove thousands of Palestinian Arabs across the borders to Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan.
In Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, the new refugees were forced into camps, unable to either go home to the newfound Israel or make new homes in the surrounding countries. They lived for decades in the worst possible conditions. Wealthier families were able to find low-income jobs and send their children to universities abroad. But the vast majority of Palestinian Arabs were left to feel forgotten, unwanted, and humiliated.
It didn't take long for groups to start forming to assert the Palestinian cause. By the mid-1950s, a number of groups had sprung up around the Arab world. One of these was Fatah, a secular political group whose leaders included the young engineer Yasser Arafat.
In the 1950s and 60s, a pattern settled into place. Palestinian revolutionary groups would attack communities along the Israeli border and try to infiltrate cities. The Israeli army would retaliate. This created more refugees who ended up in camps in Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. The leaders of those countries continued to pay just enough lip service to the Palestinian cause to keep the refugees from turning against them.
In one such play in 1964, Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser helped create the umbrella organization known as the Palestine Liberation Organization, or the PLO, as a sort of Palestinian government in exile. The Syrian government, seeing this as a power move by Nasser, decided to sponsor more militant revolutionary groups.
This decision inadvertently triggered a bigger crisis, the Six-Day War. In 1967, Syria, Egypt, and Jordan united to face down Israel, which had threatened to invade Syria to stop the militant group's attacks. When the Israeli military unexpectedly decimated the three Arab countries' military and seized land from each of them, the Palestinian refugees realized they couldn't count on other governments to help them.
Morale was low. Arafat knew that the only thing to do was to keep fighting. So Fatah continued to conduct raids into Israel, though most were unsuccessful. But in 1968, when a group of Fatah fighters known as Fedayeen unexpectedly held off an attack by the much better equipped Israeli military on a Fatah base in Jordan, the tide finally turned.
By mid-1969, his numbers and financial support swelling, Arafat attempted to unite all the groups in the PLO. He ousted the PLO president, and the Jordan-based Fatah became practically synonymous with the umbrella organization. With such a large mandate, Arafat laid out his plan to conduct an ostensibly legitimate military war against Israel in order to reclaim Palestinian land and return the refugees to their homes.
But not all the groups in the PLO agreed. A group known as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, or the PFLP, refused to stop carrying out terrorist attacks on Israel. Since July 1968, the PFLP had been hijacking airplanes bound for Israel, taking hostages in exchange for the release of imprisoned fighters, and killing people across Europe and the Middle East.
Fatah condemned the PFLP's terrorist attacks, concerned that they would reflect badly on the Palestinian cause, but they had no control over the group.
The Israelis, however, couldn't let the attacks go unpunished. In retaliation, they attacked Lebanon's air fleet, indicating that Israel would hold the terrorist host countries responsible for the terrorists' actions.
In response, Lebanon began to crack down on the PFLP and other Palestinian liberation groups. In Jordan, King Hussein was becoming concerned that Fatah was getting too powerful and that the Palestinians were building a shadow state within his. How would he be able to curb their activities?
In September 1970, the situation came to a head. On September 6th, four airplanes were hijacked by PFLP terrorists, and 425 people were held hostage at an airfield in the Jordanian desert. Ultimately, the hostages were released, but not before the world saw terrorists blow up three international airliners in Jordan.
King Hussein and the Jordanian government had had enough. The military was chomping at the bit to take action against both the terrorists and the Palestinian militant groups that walked around like they owned Jordan. And so King Hussein and Prime Minister Wasfi Tell gave the order to strike back.
In the ensuing violence, thousands of Fedayeen were killed. The refugee camps suspected of harboring fighters were bombed. The Syrian military tried to send backup to the Palestinians, but the Jordanians defeated them too. By the time Nasser managed to negotiate a ceasefire between Arafat and King Hussein, Fatah, the PFLP, and every other Palestinian liberation group had been decimated.
The Palestinians called it a Black September.
Fatah and the PLO spent the next year rebuilding, but morale was low. The Palestinians had been betrayed by fellow Arabs. The world didn't care about their plight.
Arafat found himself at risk of losing control of the PLO. He tried to argue that the liberation groups would have to fight using political rather than military power. But a large swath of the Palestinian Arab population, especially young people, were angry and wanted to see direct action.
And so, Arafat and some of the other Fatah leaders decided to let off some steam. They didn't want terrorism to become an official policy, but neither did they want to lose power. So a handful of leaders decided to set up a new group, officially and financially separate from Fatah and the PLO, that could carry out actions to advance the Palestinian cause. The group was called Black September, in honor of the Jordanian attack the previous year.
As one of the leaders, Abu Daud, explained it, quote, There is no such thing as Black September. Fatah announced its operations under this name so that Fatah will not appear as the direct executor of the actions, end quote.
By doing this, Fatah and Arafat were able to placate the more extreme factions within the PLO and maintain power without ever being directly implicated in terrorism.
Because of Black September's structure, those carrying out the attacks were never the leadership. Training camps for various PLO groups had been operating around the Middle East since the 1950s, giving the organization a virtually bottomless pool of angry young Palestinians and idealists from around the world who wanted to fight for the cause.
From these camps, Black September could select the most dedicated and angriest fighters, those who were willing to put their very lives on the line for Palestine.
Those fighters were then sent on to more elite training camps, which would prepare them for a specific Black September mission. From those, an even smaller group would be chosen to carry out the actual attack. The details of the mission wouldn't be revealed until as late as possible, with only one or two team leaders aware of the plan in advance.
By late 1971, Black September was ready to make itself known.
Black September burst onto the international stage in dramatic fashion on the afternoon of November 28, 1971. Its first terrorist attack was designed to show that the Palestinians could not be beaten up on with impunity, that they could and would fight back.
That afternoon, four commandos lounged in the lobby of the Cairo Sheraton Hotel, having a lunch of sandwiches and Coca-Colas.
Simultaneously, the Jordanian Prime Minister, Wasfi Tell, was having a decadent lunch in town with the Secretary General of the Arab League.
After lunch, Tell returned to the Cairo Sheraton, where he was staying and where his wife was waiting for him in the lobby.
As soon as he walked through the large glass doors, Esat Raba, one of the Black September commandos, jumped up from his chair and fired five shots into the Prime Minister.
Tell started to reach for his own gun, but he was dead before he hit the marble floor, his blood pooling around him.
Before running away, another of the commandos, Munzer Khalifa, bent down and licked Tell's blood from the floor.
The Prime Minister's wife, hearing the shots, raced to her dead husband and cursed the murderers, knowing them to be Palestinian. She screamed after them that Palestine was finished.
When the four men were arrested by the police, they proudly took responsibility for the murder. Khalifa flashed the victory sign and said, quote, "I am proud. We have taken our revenge on a traitor," end quote.
Next, we'll find out how Black September planned its most ambitious attack ever.
Now, back to the story.
After the assassination of Wasfi Tell, Black September's next attack was on another Jordanian politician who'd played a significant role in the September 1970 massacre, the Jordanian ambassador to the UK. The assassination attempt in London failed. But the brazen shooting at the ambassador's car once again captured the world's attention and raised Black September's profile.
For the next year, the group continued to carry out terrorist attacks across Europe and the Middle East. Jordanians accused of working with Israel were murdered. Oil tanks owned by Gulf countries were blown up. German factories making engines for Israel were destroyed.
A handful of their activities were foiled as well. Most significantly, the hijacking of a flight from Brussels to Tel Aviv on May 8, 1972, whose 87 hostages were to be exchanged for more than 200 fedayeen imprisoned in Israeli jails. If the Israelis didn't comply by the deadline, the four hostage takers would blow up the plane, killing everyone, including themselves. But an Israeli special forces team was able to storm the plane, killing two of the terrorists, capturing the other two, and rescuing the hostages.
The humiliation of Black September's failure on the world stage and at the Israelis' hands prompted the organization's leaders to carefully consider their next move. They needed to do something that would remind the world that the Palestinians might be weak and stateless, but they could still fight back.
Simultaneously, the world was focused on something else, the upcoming 20th Olympic Games, to be held in Munich in late August and early September.
In early 1972, the PLO had sent an official letter asking that a Palestinian team be allowed to compete in the Olympics. They never heard back, so they sent another letter. Still, no reply. The lack of response was seen not just as an insult and a snub, but as a neutral international organization choosing to support Israel, which would be sending a team.
To the PLO, this was the international community saying that nobody cared about the Palestinian people, that they might as well not exist.
Black September decided it was time to make the world understand that the Palestinians did exist, and if they could strike a blow at the Israelis in the process, even better.
In July 1972, Black September leaders Abu Iyad, Abu Daoud, and Fakhri al-Umari devised an audacious plan. It would require meticulous planning and a lot of luck. But if it succeeded, it would be the group's boldest strike yet.
They called it Operation Ikrit and Berim, after two ancient Arab Christian villages in the north of Israel whose inhabitants had been forced from their homes in 1948.
While Abu Daoud sourced the weapons for the attack, Abu Iyad planned the particulars and picked the team. Only the two leaders of the team would know the full plan, and they would have to do a lot of heavy lifting, which meant they had to be men that Abu Iyad knew he could count on.
He chose two experienced fedayeen, men he claimed had fought in Jordan in September 1970 and further battles in 1971. They were smart, capable, dedicated to the cause, and most importantly, had lived in Germany.
All we know for sure about these two men are their code names, Issa and Tony, who also went by Che, in homage to the Latin American revolutionary. All other information about them was kept deliberately opaque by Black September.
Issa, the leader, could have been one of a couple people, though most people seem to think he was Latif Afif. The 35-year-old Afif, born in Nazareth, was actually the son of a Jewish woman and an Arab Christian businessman. He'd studied engineering in Germany in the late 50s and early 60s, before working in France. Like his three brothers, he joined Fatah in the mid-60s, then joining Black September upon its inception. Two of his brothers were languishing in Israeli jails. By 1970, he was living in Berlin, engaged to a German woman.
Tony, the second in command, was likely 25-year-old Yusuf Nazal, a committed fighter and charismatic tactician, but reports on who he really was are sketchy at best. Some reports say he was a law student in either Paris or Munich, while others claim he worked for a Munich oil company.
With a month until the Olympics started, the two leaders got to work in Munich, and Abu Iyad had to assemble the rest of the team. He assembled a group of about 50 dedicated young guerrillas for an intense month of training in Libya in order to decide who would ultimately make the cut.
According to Abu Iyad, almost all the fighters came from poor refugee families, had grown up in the camps, and had family members in Israeli prisons. These were young men who felt they had nothing to lose and everything to gain. They knew nothing of the mission, but they were prepared to die for the cause if it meant striking a blow at the Israelis.
Finally, the six commandos were chosen. 19-year-old Jamal Al-Gashay was born and raised in Shatila, one of the most impoverished Palestinian refugee camps. He grew up on stories of his family's homeland and believed that he and his friends and family had no future unless they were able to return home.
Jamal's 27-year-old uncle, Adnan Al-Gashay, also grew up in the Shatila refugee camp, though he'd seen more of the world than his nephew. A confident, self-assured young man, he'd started as a nursing student in Tripoli before getting a scholarship to study chemistry at the American University of Beirut.
Khalid Jawad was a talented soccer player who'd lived in West Germany for several years. Afif Ahmed Hamid, a Fatah fighter since 1966, had lived in Germany for several years before returning to Lebanon in 1971. Ahmed Sheikh Ta still lived in Berlin and was married to a German woman. And Mohammed Safadi, aged 19, was a passionate young man desperate to do his part.
The young men had no idea what mission they'd been chosen for, but they were spoiling for a fight. The fact that they'd been chosen was an honor, even if they couldn't tell anyone else about it.
The Israeli Olympic delegation were neither politicians nor military men. The 9 men, ultimately taken hostage, hadn't even all done Israel's mandatory 2 years of national military service. Some of the coaches and officials were professionals, but the athletes were amateurs who had lives outside their sport. Most had young families.
Yosef Gutfrund, the hulking wrestling referee, fit almost all those descriptions. The Romanian-born 40-year-old had also refereed at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics, but his day job was as a businessman in Tel Aviv, where he lived with his wife and preteen daughter.
28-year-old weightlifter David Berger had only recently moved to Israel. Not only did he have MBA and law degrees from Columbia University, but he was actually American-born and raised in Ohio, where his parents still lived. After winning a gold medal in the 1969 Maccabiah Games, he moved to Tel Aviv with the intention of opening a law firm.
For wrestling coach Moshe Weinberg, the Olympics were fun, but they were also an inconvenience. His wife, Miriam, had given birth to their son, Guri, just days before he had to leave for Munich. The 33-year-old barely had time to stay for his son's bris before he had to set off with the team for Munich. He was anxious to get home to spend more time with his newborn son.
For the 27-year-old fencing coach, Andre Spitzer, the Olympics had been a lifelong dream. Romanian by birth, Spitzer moved to Israel with his mother at age 11. But fencing was a constant throughout his life. He studied it at the Israeli National Sports Academy before going to the Netherlands to perfect his skills and become an instructor.
The lanky young man picked up the Dutch language quickly, and his friendly, open personality helped him to make friends easily. When he met a young Dutch woman named Ankie, the two fell head over heels in love. Within no time, they were spending all their time together and having a blast.
When they got married, Ankie was worried that Andre wouldn't have enough family and friends at the wedding. After all, he'd only been in the Netherlands for a few years. But Andre was the sort of guy who made friends quickly, and more than half their guests were friends of his.
After the wedding, the couple decided to move back to Israel so that Andre could fulfill his dream of opening a fencing academy there. They were poor, and it was a hard life, but some of Andre's students were on track for the Israeli Olympic team, and Andre had long dreamt of the camaraderie and unifying spirit of sports at the Olympics.
A month before the 1972 Munich Olympics, Ankie gave birth to their daughter. The young family didn't want to be apart for the whole month of the Olympics, but neither did Ankie want Andre to miss out on his dream. So the family picked up and went to Europe together, with Ankie taking the baby to stay with her parents in the Netherlands before going to meet Andre in Munich.
The apartments in the Olympic Village were single gender, so the Spitzers got a cheap hotel room nearby where they stayed together most of the time. Even when Ankie did come to the village, security was lax enough that she didn't have any trouble getting in.
The couple spent most of their time exploring Munich and reveling in the Olympic spirit. Andre couldn't believe he was finally here. One day, he spotted a bunch of Lebanese athletes and went over to say hi, despite Anki's concern. He introduced himself as Israeli and asked how their events had gone. The Lebanese were equally happy to chat with him, and they traded stories of their Olympic experiences before parting ways.
Returning to his wife, Andre couldn't stop grinning, saying, quote, "This is what I was dreaming about." For Andre, the Olympics were all about helping people come together through sport, building relationships separate from politics and world affairs.
After the Israeli fencing team finished their events, Andre got permission from the Israeli delegation's officials to go with Anki back to the Netherlands for a few days to see their baby daughter. He just had to be back for September 5th.
On September 4th, though, Andre missed his train. The baby had been ill and in the hospital, and he just wanted to give her one more kiss. But the trip to the hospital made him too late to make the train.
Andre wasn't worried. He would just go back to Munich the next day. But Anki was panicked that he would get in trouble for not getting back in time. So she insisted upon driving 30 miles to another train station where he was able to make another train. He jumped on the train without a ticket as it was leaving the station and promised to call Anki as soon as he arrived in Munich.
He arrived back at the Olympic Village around midnight to find it empty. He didn't realize that the others had gone out for the evening. He called Anki and they talked until he ran out of coins, but he promised to call again in the morning. After the break, we'll explore the night of the attack. Now back to the story.
While Andre Spitzer was hurrying back to Munich to meet his teammates, the Black September Commandos were finally putting their plan into action.
2 weeks prior, two members of the organization had landed at Cologne Airport, posing as an Arabic businessman and his wife. They were traveling with four bulging suitcases when a customs officer stopped them and asked them to open their bags. The man proclaimed his outrage at the insult. Finally, he agreed.
The suitcase that the officer asked him to open was full of women's lingerie. The couple was allowed into Germany.
Had the officer asked the man to open any other bag, he would have found all the weapons for the attack. 8 machine guns, 10 grenades, and a veritable armory of bullets.
The couple then met up with Black September leader Abu Iyad, and the three of them drove to Munich. They stashed the suitcases in lockers at the Munich Central train station, then dropped the keys at a nearby hotel where the leaders of the mission could pick them up.
Issa and Tony, the two leaders of the mission, had been in Germany for some time. Issa had managed to get a job as an engineer at the Olympic Village, while Tony had gotten a job there as a cook. This meant they were able to explore pretty freely and copy any necessary keys. By the time they were ready to carry out the attack, the two of them knew the village's layout, traffic patterns, and security protocols like the back of their hands.
And what they discovered, what the world discovered, was that the Munich Olympics were different.
It was 1972, less than 30 years after the end of World War II, and 36 years after the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, which Hitler had used as a terrifying celebration of Nazi Germany.
The capitalist, democratic West Germans were determined to prove that their horrific past was behind them and that West Germany was a welcoming, peaceful, happy place. They declared the 1972 Olympics the Games of Peace and Joy, and they threw open their doors to the world.
And for the most part, it worked. All kinds of people from all around the world flocked to Munich, and friendliness was on overdrive. Athletic records were set that lasted for decades, and athletes were able to bridge the divides and stereotypes that were haunting the world through the Cold War, Vietnam War, and others.
One of the most important things to the Germans was that all traces of Nazi militarism and authoritarianism be erased from the world's view of Germany. This meant no guns.
Imagine how it would have looked to have thousands of uniformed guards carrying machine guns standing at attention throughout Munich, just decades after the Nazis had invaded large swaths of Europe and murdered millions of people.
So, the German Olympic Committee decided it would be better to cut down on armed security. They dressed the security officers in stylish, light blue uniforms and took away their weapons. The guards would be a constant presence, but a friendly one, there to keep an eye on things and enforce the rules.
But in the Olympic Village, even the rules were barely enforced. Just as Andre Spitzer's wife could come and go from the team's apartments without a problem, most of the athletes regularly stayed out way past the village's curfew in order to make the most of Munich's famous beer halls, clambering over the village's fences with fellow athletes while the security guards looked the other way became a popular pastime.
Once Isa and Tony had scoped out the Olympic Village and finalized preparations for the attack, they were ready for the six other commandos to arrive.
Several days before the date they decided upon, the other armed men arrived in Munich in two groups of three. One group consisted of Jamal Al-Gashay, his uncle Adnan Al-Gashay, and Afif Ahmed Hamid. The other included Khalid Jawad, Ahmed Sheikh Tah, and Mohammed Safadi.
Isa and Tony met them and took them to small hotels near the train station. Still, the young commandos hadn't been given any details on their mission.
In the meantime, they had a few days to wait. Jamal Al-Gashay and his uncle went to watch a few Olympic volleyball games and explored the Bavarian capital.
Finally, on the night of September 4th, 1972, the leaders gathered their team for a dinner at the restaurant in Munich's central train station. It's possible that masterminds Abu Iyad and Ali Hassan Salame were there as well to debrief the full team on the plan.
There, for the first time, the full team of eight Fedayeen learned that their mission would have three objectives.
First was to affirm the existence of the Palestinian people, since the international community seemed so determined to forget them.
Second was to gain as much coverage as possible for the Palestinian cause, quote, by taking advantage of the extraordinary concentration of mass media at Munich, end quote. They didn't care if the coverage was positive or negative, buying into the idea that there is no such thing as bad press.
The third objective, and probably the most difficult, would be to force Israel to release 200 imprisoned Fedayeen.
In order to accomplish these goals, the Black September team was going to kidnap as many members of the Israeli Olympic team as possible and hold them hostage until the imprisoned Fedayeen had been released.
According to research psychiatrist David A. Soskis and FBI Special Agent Clinton R. Van Zandt, this kind of plan is common in terrorism-driven hostage situations. When the goal is to bring attention to a cause, the violence perpetrated is as much about the audience as it is about the hostages. By choosing the Olympics as the venue for the hostage situation, Black September guaranteed they'd have the entire world as an audience.
The six new arrivals were thrilled. This was what they'd been waiting for. They'd finally be able to strike Israel directly and get back at the people who had driven them from their homeland.
As the commandos set out for the Olympic Village, they were as buoyant and excited as the Israeli team who had just returned home from Fiddler on the Roof and were anticipating their remaining competitions.
The Israeli team arrived back at the Olympic Village shortly after midnight. The men headed over to their five apartments on Connolly Strasse and crawled into bed, exhausted, happy, and ready for the last few days of the games.
The Black September commandos arrived at the Olympic Village around 4 a.m. and split into two groups of four. They were dressed in athletic tracksuits and carrying duffel bags, so they blended in with the Olympic athletes heading home for the night.
In fact, one group even encountered a group of drunk American athletes climbing over the fence. The terrorists helped the Americans, who in turn helped them. Once inside, they said goodnight to each other and waved goodbye.
A group of German postal workers later claim to have seen at least one of the Black September groups and may have even reported them. But the sight of athletes climbing over the fence was so common that it didn't seem like an issue.
By 4:30 a.m., the attackers had reached the Israeli men's apartments on Connollystrasse. The apartments opened onto the pedestrian street from the ground floor, something the head of the Israeli delegation had protested to no avail. Antoni and Esau had keys.
Counting on the element of surprise, they tried the door on apartment one, but the key didn't seem to work. They jiggled it and kept trying as all eight of them stood with their machine guns out at the ready.
The noise of the key jiggling in the door woke Josef Gutfreund, the towering wrestling referee. He stumbled out of bed in only his underwear, confused, not wanting to waken the other coaches and officials in the apartment.
The key finally worked. Gutfreund arrived at the door just in time to see the door start to open and masked men carrying machine guns beyond it. The terrorist had lost the element of surprise.
In the melee that followed, as Gutfreund tried to block the door and shouted to the others, only one man escaped. Weightlifting coach Tuvia Sokolovsky. After punching through the window, he ran through the garden and hid behind a concrete planter until he could go for help.
But his escape was only a matter of seconds. Gutfreund held the attackers off for maybe 10 seconds before they managed to knock him over and rush into the apartment, guns out.
The attackers went into each bedroom, pulling the sleepy men from their beds. They forced the men, including track coach Amitzer Shapira and Holocaust survivor Yakov Springer, into the second-floor bedroom that fencing coach Andre Spitzer shared with the 53-year-old shooting coach, Kehat Shore. Shore, a Romanian, had become an expert marksman fighting the Nazis in World War II.
But Moshe Weinberg, the wrestling coach and new father, anxious to see his son back in Israel, wasn't going to give up without a fight. He'd been awakened by Gutfreund's shouts and the machine gun fire after Sokolovsky. And he heard the attackers as they raided his friend's rooms.
When Isa, the commander, swung Weinberg's door open, the tall wrestler was ready for him. He had a fruit knife, and he lunged at Isa with it. But the only damage he did was to catch the commander off balance and cut through his shirt pocket.
But one of the other terrorists was faster than Isa. He fired a round at Weinberg, and the bullets ripped through the coach's cheek, sending blood pouring from his face.
The terrorist tied up the five other coaches and officials in Spitzer and Shore's room, leaving Isa and two others to stand guard. Then, Tony and four of the others took the bleeding Weinberg with them to find more hostages.
For whatever reason, the terrorists skipped apartment two and continued on to apartment three. Some researchers have suggested that the choice was Weinberg's, that Tony might have demanded he take them to where the other Israelis were sleeping. Despite being wounded, Weinberg clearly wasn't experiencing the paralyzing frozen fright that doctors David A. Alexander and Susan Klein described as one of the most common reactions to being taken hostage. So, still looking to escape, it's possible that Weinberg could have thought that the wrestlers and weightlifters in apartment three stood a better chance of fending off the attackers.
But Isa and Tony had done a thorough reconnaissance, so it seems more likely that they knew apartment two housed the sharpshooters, who might have guns on them. The unarmed fighters likely seemed like a safer bet. Maybe they just took the bleeding Weinberg with them to scare the others into submission.
When the masked gunman burst through the door, the athletes in apartment three were caught completely by surprise. The attackers shouted, butting the Olympians with their guns. Still in their underwear, dazed from the harsh wake-up, the young men were corralled into the living room.
David Berger, the American, tried to galvanize his friends, whispering in Hebrew, "Let's charge them. We've got nothing to lose."
But one of the attackers understood him and slammed his gun into Berger's back.
The terrorists then marched the apartment 3 athletes and Weinberg back to apartment 1.
At the door to apartment 1 from Connolly Strauss, one could either continue into the apartment or go downstairs to the parking garage. As God Sabari, a 100-pound flyweight wrestler, was pushed through the front door at the front of the line, Berger's words rang through his head, "We've got nothing to lose."
So, instead of going into the apartment, he pushed the barrel of his captor's gun in front of him out of the way and ran down the winding stairs.
Caught off guard, the terrorist fired a few shots after him, but Sabari zigzagged and used the parking garage's pillars to make himself less of a target. He managed to escape unscathed and went for help.
At the apartment, the quick-thinking Weinberg took advantage of the confusion caused by Sabari's escape and tried to grab one of the terrorist's guns.
But another captor saw Weinberg and fired a few rounds at him, riddling him with bullets and killing him instantly.
They shoved the rest of the athletes into the apartment, pulled Weinberg's body inside, and locked the door.
The whole ordeal had taken less than 10 minutes. Thanks to the gunfire and to Sabari and Sokolovsky raising the alarm, the authorities and the rest of the Olympic Village had realized that something was wrong.
The Black September team took stock of the situation. It wasn't ideal that they'd had to kill someone already. They'd been told to avoid it unless explicitly attacked. But they reasoned that Weinberg had attacked them. They viewed their action as self-defense.
As they conferred, Josef Romano, a 32-year-old weightlifter with a huge grin and 3 young daughters at home, sized up the captors. He was bigger and stronger than these guys. If he could just get one of their guns, he and his friends would stand a chance.
Counting on the element of surprise, Romano tackled one of the terrorists, sending him to the ground.
He almost had the man's gun. But the other commandos were too fast. They sprayed Romano with bullets, then left him to bleed out in the middle of the room.
After that, none of the other hostages tried to escape.
The remaining 4 athletes were herded upstairs to the room with the others, where they too were tied up.
It was barely 5 a.m., and 8 Black September terrorists had taken 9 Israeli Olympians hostage and murdered 2 more.
There were still 22 hours to go before the ordeal would be over. Next week on Hostage, we'll follow the tense negotiations between the Black Septemberists and the Bavarian, German, and Israeli governments, all of whom know that the Israeli government doesn't negotiate for hostages.
And we'll delve into the complex political situation and surprising German incompetence that led to a tragic resolution. You can listen to Hostage and all of Parcast's other podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, CastBox, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast directory. And if you enjoy the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.
We'll be back next week.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Aidan Connolly. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. Hostage is written by Kate Thorman and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.